From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the economy of the new Iraq, where it's hard to keep a legit business going, but the black market is thriving. We talk with Edmund Andrews, who just got back from 2 months in Iraq. He's an economic correspondent for the New York Times. Also, we meet Gary Louris, lead singer for the alternative country band The Jayhawks. Their latest CD is called Rainy Day Music. A review in Rolling Stone said, "There isn't much music on your radio dial that sounds so quintessentially bittersweet." That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. Today, President Bush told the people of Botswana, where the AIDS infection rate is the highest in the world, that they will not face the pandemic alone. The president touted his $15 billion pledge to fund AIDS prevention and treatment in Africa and the Caribbean.
The first thing I wanted the leadership in Africa to know is the American people care deeply about the pandemic that sweeps across this continent, the pandemic of HIV/AIDS, that we're not only a powerful nation, we're also a compassionate nation.
But today, a House committee voted to trim this year's appropriation for the program by a third. Secretary of State Powell said the administration will work with what Congress gives it. Botswana is the third of five stops on the president's Africa tour. Uganda is next, and then Nigeria. In South Africa today, Secretary of State Colin Powell addressed the controversy over how the Bush administration justified going to war in Iraq.
Secretary of State Powell here in Pretoria vigorously defended the U.S. decision to go to war against Iraq, and he defended the administration against charges that it used false information to make the case for war. Powell told reporters here that, this is a quote, "There was no effort or attempt on the part of the president or anyone else in the administration to mislead or to deceive the American people." He went on to say that the interpretation of the intelligence that they had at the time was reasonable.
NPR's Don Gagne reporting from Pretoria on remarks by Secretary of State Colin Powell. The general who commanded the Iraq War told a congressional committee today that the U.S. force in Iraq is likely to stay at the current level for the rest of the year. NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
Army General Tommy Franks, who this week relinquished his Middle East command, said he believes the U.S. military presence in Iraq will be maintained at about 148,000 troops for the rest of this year at least. There could be some reduction next year, Franks told the House Armed Services Committee, but he does see U.S. troops staying in Iraq as long as it takes to establish a good, functioning Iraqi government.
I anticipate that we will be involved in Iraq in the future, and, sir, I don't know whether that means 2 years or 4 years.
General Franks is more cautious on this point than his boss, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. When Franks first made his prediction before a Senate committee, Rumsfeld said he wanted to amend it, saying there could be a smaller U.S. force if other countries contribute more troops. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
Blue chip stocks suffered a triple-digit loss today, and the Nasdaq Composite ended a three-day winning streak. The Dow Industrials finished down 120 points at 9,036 in active trade. The Nasdaq was down 31 at 1715. The Standard & Poor's 500 was down 13 points. This is NPR News. A rule change that would limit the amount of overtime pay federal white-collar workers could receive was retained in a House Labor, Health, and Education bill today. Republicans beat back Democratic and labor opposition. President Bush said he would veto the entire bill unless the provision was included. The Labor Department says the proposed rules would also require overtime pay for more than 1 million additional low-wage federal workers who work more than 40 hours per week. A Florida jury has convicted a Cuban man in the hijacking of an airliner to Key West earlier this year. NPR's Philip Davis has more.
It took the jury only about an hour to agree that Adermis Wilson Gonzalez was guilty of the April 1st hijacking. According to witness accounts, Wilson brandished two hand grenades once the plane was airborne and threatened to blow the plane up unless he was taken to Florida. The plane stopped to take on fuel in Havana, where, according to testimony, Cuban leader Fidel Castro personally tried to convince Wilson to give himself up. But Wilson insisted on being taken to Key West, where, instead of being allowed to seek asylum like most Cubans, he was promptly arrested. 10 of the 31 other passengers on board, however, did seek asylum and were allowed to remain in America. The U.S. attorney aggressively prosecuted the case, saying that while it was understandable many sought to leave Cuba, to do so by force was unacceptable. Wilson now faces up to 20 years in prison. Philip Davis, NPR News, Miami.
Fire crews are fighting a blaze that threatens the Rio Pueblo in New Mexico, a river Native Americans there consider sacred. The fire has already burned parts of the Rio Pueblo watershed. There are at least 20 other fires burning in the West. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Amundsen Foundation, for support of the Endowment Fund for NPR West, NPR's new production center in Los Angeles.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Journalist Edmund Andrews returned home late last week after covering Iraq for 2 months. He's a New York Times economic correspondent based in Washington, D.C., and he's a former foreign correspondent. After writing about the Bush tax plan, the Fed, and the politics of American economic policy, Andrews wanted to report on the economy of the new Iraq. He had previously written about the rebuilding of post-communist countries, but he assumes that reshaping Iraq's economy is going to be different, in part because of the unique legacy of Saddam Hussein, in part because it's the United States that now has responsibility for the country. A lot of things in Iraq have not gone as the Bush administration predicted. One example is the strength of the Iraqi currency, the dinar. One of the things that you wrote about with the Iraqi economy was the dinar. Americans expected it to collapse, in part because it had Saddam's picture on the bill. What were the expectations for the dinar?
You're right. A lot of people expected the dinar to collapse. It had been a very weak currency leading into the war. Its official value set by the Iraqi government was, I think, $3 to the dinar, and on the street it was worth typically around 2,000 dinars to the dollar. And before I left for Baghdad, I interviewed people at the Treasury Department, and their prediction, their assumption really, was that the dinar was essentially going to disappear, that the country would need a new currency, but in the meantime, dollars would be the currency for the foreseeable future. The Treasury didn't want Iraq to become a dollar economy, but they surely expected that the Saddam dinars were going to be worthless, collapse, and that dollars would do the job until something new and more stable was devised.
But that's not what happened.
That's not at all what happened. And this was a personal surprise to me, because when I was getting ready to go to Iraq from Kuwait, I'd been told to stock up on small denomination dollar bills. Never even occurred to me that I would be needing to get dinars. When I arrived, the first thing I found, as everybody else did, was that if you paid a bill in dollars, you were going to pay more. They were going to give you a haircut of about 20%. And it wasn't because they were taking advantage of you. It's because they truly didn't really like dealing in dollars. They had to change them. The dinars were still the most comfortable currency for them to use. The bigger surprise was that in the real market of life, on the streets, the dinar stabilized in value, actually increased in value. Before the war, or during the war, I believe dinars were trading at about 3,000. That was probably the low point, somewhere around 3,000 dinar to the dollar. But the value went up, and within a few weeks of the time I arrived, the dinar had actually risen to the point where a dollar was worth only 900 dinars. So it was an incredible rise in value that occurred. There are a lot of theories as to why it happened. One simple reason is that they stopped printing dinars, or new dinars, so the stock of them was very stable. There wasn't a need for them to lose value. And they were, in fact, the most practical currency for a lot of people. The other thing that really, I think, caught the Americans by surprise, I don't think they were thinking about this clearly enough, was that they were paying Iraqi government workers in dollars. They were handing out $20 emergency payments, the famous $20 emergency payments that they gave to millions of people. These were in dollars. And then the salaries and pensions, as they began paying them, were also in dollars. These all ended up flooding the market, and they were, again, a currency that people preferred not to use just for practical reasons. And so the dollar just took a steep fall in value. The final wrinkle in that story is that the demand for dinars got so high that the U.S. government had to swallow its pride and start printing extra batches of the basic 250-dinar note just to keep up with demand for regular business.
So were the Americans printing dinars with Saddam Hussein's picture on them?
Yes, they did. They didn't like it, but they did it.
Well, another complication in this story, which you wrote about for the New York Times, was that a lot of people had 10,000 dinar notes. I mean, denominations of 10,000. Because when they were getting ready for war, they wanted to have bigger notes so that they could travel more lightly, you know, have fewer bills to carry. But they couldn't get change at the stores. So they went to the bank, and there was a run on the bank. Why don't you describe the scene when you got to the bank and what it was about?
Well, imagine, if you will, dozens of people, maybe even 100, lining up outside of a bank at 5 o'clock in the morning just for the chance to change their big 10,000 dinar notes into smaller notes. Then imagine, if you will, come the time of the bank opening, about 8:30 in the morning, protected by two huge tanks, razor wire all over the place to guide people through just a very narrow channel, one person at a time, into the bank, and then tempers rising with each passing minute and hour as all of these people find out that they cannot, the bank will really not change, give them basic change. They would not change their 10,000 dinar notes into an equivalent number of 250 dinar notes. And the scene was just extraordinary. We just stumbled upon it one day. It turned out to be taking place day after day. People screaming, yelling, accusing the bank of favoring the wealthy or their own employees. The soldiers desperately trying to keep order. I'll never forget this one poor sergeant standing on his tank, or standing right in front of his tank, and hollering out in English, you know, "No more money. There is no more money. Do you understand?" And pleading with people to give up for the day and go home and maybe try again, because at some point in the future they might be able to get change. There might be some relief to this ridiculous currency shortage. So suddenly these people realized that as many hours as they had been waiting in all of that heat and with their the numbers that they had been given to stand in line, they still weren't going to get the change that they wanted, and they had to go home. And it was enormously frustrating for them, and I felt sorry for the GIs who were trying to explain this in English.
So they had money. What they didn't have is, like, small enough denominations of the money.
It looked like a run on the bank, where the bank was unable or unwilling to let people withdraw their money. What it really was simply an inability to make change. So one of the simplest things in the world, but in post-war Iraq, turned out to be a highly complicated problem.
The dinar comes in two denominations, 10,000 and 250 dinars. What are they each worth in American dollars?
A 10,000 dinar note is worth about $7, and the 250 dinar note is worth about 20 cents, depending on the rate of exchange that day. And the problem is that if you, for most of your shopping, you have no choice but to use a 250 dinar note, which means that you have to carry around wads of these bills several inches thick and be very quick at learning how to count them. And in 2 months, I never actually got the hang of flipping those bills fast enough to count them properly.
My guest is Edmund Andrews, and he writes about economics for the New York Times. He just got back from Iraq, and one of the stories he was covering there is the state of the new Iraqi economy. I'm sure there's a lot of people in Iraq who would like to start their own businesses now. Can you just, like, start a business, or do you need authorization?
This is the question that Iraqis keep asking. They've been so used to being told what they have to do, they are begging to know what the rules are. And the Americans, unfortunately, have not been able to tell them very much about this. The beautiful thing about Iraq at the moment is that it is almost a country without rules, without laws. So you, for the moment, can do almost anything you want. You can import and export to your heart's content. There are no tariffs at the border. There's no customs checks by the Iraqis. Nobody's going to stop you from setting up a business. At some point, you're going to have to deal with the authorities, but that time has not come. So it is a free-for-all economy.
So do you think that a lot of international businesses are ready to move into Iraq and to conquer a new market?
No. I think that they are fascinated by Iraq. I know this. I've spoken to a lot of executives from Western companies now, not in Iraq, outside of Iraq. And what they generally say is, we're fascinated. It's a big country. It's a complex one with potentially a lot of wealth. We want to be there, but it's too early. The country is too unstable. We don't know what the rules are. We just don't know how to approach this place yet. And so it's a black box to them. Nobody really knows what to do.
So some things are just stalled.
Correct. It's very stalled. And I have to say that I'm just not impressed by the speed and the effectiveness with which the coalition authorities have tried to deal with these issues. In fact, I've been outraged in a couple of cases at their willingness to shoot down business projects because they, for one reason or another, didn't feel that they had the authority to allow things to happen. The worst case was, I think, cell phones. Iraq, Baghdad, none of the cities have proper telephone communications because the phone systems were knocked out so badly. It's really very easy to set up a cell phone system. Can be done really in a matter of weeks, if not for the whole city, just for several thousand phones, 50,000 phones, not that hard. And the Americans absolutely refused to award any licenses to anybody on any terms. And my argument to some of them was, look, I understand how you don't want to give valuable phone licenses to countries before you have a true Iraqi government, but couldn't you at least offer the possibility that companies could have a 2-year license, and then it would be completely up for renegotiation with the new government? That was impossible. And so as a result, Iraq still has no proper phones of any kind, cellular, landline, nothing. I should say they do have some fixed-line phones, but most people don't have any service. We certainly didn't. Our only communications were by satellite phones.
My guest is New York Times economic correspondent Edmund Andrews. He spent 2 months in Iraq and returned home late last week. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is Edmund Andrews. He is a reporter for the New York Times. He's an economics correspondent based in Washington, but he spent the past few weeks in Iraq. He returned on Friday night, and he was mostly writing about economic issues in the new Iraq. What were you able to see about the black market in Iraq?
Oh, it's lovely. It's a wonderful thing. It's not a black market, really, because there are no laws. I guess a black market is when you're doing things in violation of the law.
Right.
One of the early experiences I had was going to the Kurdish stolen car market, which was very out in the open, and it was a place where you could buy all kinds of SUVs and trucks and some sedans, but really fairly late model ones, most of which had been taken from the government, looted from the government, and were up for sale for, say, $5,000, $6,000. Some of them hot-wired, and if you needed it, you could get a driver's license for about $12, passport, inspection stickers, anything else you needed.
So when you went to the stolen car market, were you looking, were you in the market for a car, or were you just there to report on it?
Of course I was just there to report on it, but if I did find a good one at a good price.
So how did they treat you as a reporter?
They were pretty nice. It was not, they knew I was a reporter in mm-hmm. that case. There was no secret about it. They were reluctant to let me take any pictures while I was there, but they didn't mind me asking questions. The scariest thing I had in the stolen car market was when the U.S. troops arrived because somebody had complained to them that a person who had just bought a car at the market had stolen it from him. And when the troops arrived, there must have been 300 people who suddenly, at a moment's notice, just ran clear across the lot and out the other end, and every car on the lot started firing up and driving off as fast as it could. And I was scared to death. I was sure somebody was going to start shooting. It turned out what it was the soldiers coming to figure out what had happened. But aside from that, it was a very friendly place.
It sounds like very few people are actually employed now in Iraq. I mean, look at all the problems that the businesses are having. What struck you about unemployment in Iraq?
It seems nobody knows what the unemployment level in Iraq is. You see estimates that range from north of 30% to 50% or more of the people being unemployed or underemployed. What was striking to me was that the U.S. government, one of the things was that the U.S. government was subsidizing really a lot of the underemployment by keeping people on payrolls even though they weren't doing anything. All of the state-owned companies, all of the government ministries, and indeed some of the sort of mixed enterprises, public and privately owned, continued to keep people on their payrolls even though there was absolutely no work to be done. And the Americans were surprisingly blunt about this. One person told me it's just not worth it to inflame things even more by putting people out of work. The least we can do is throw a few more deaners into the economy. So you had really a make-work society in the evolution, exactly the kind of thing we are supposed to detest in this country, but a make-work society evolving and one that was being underwritten by the U.S. government.
Did you get a sense of what the Iraqi attitude was toward the Americans who were paying them even though they weren't working?
The people I talked to had a curious sense of entitlement. Now, a lot of these people were in the government ministries or in the state-owned companies. And the curious thing to me was that nobody thought it was strange that they should be getting paid for no work. It was just what they expected. They had done nothing to lose their job or prevent their ability to work. It was somebody else's fault. So what should be strange about getting paid for no work? And I don't know how this is going to work its way out. At some point, there will be a shock. There absolutely will be a shock. It will not go on. And I fear that it will be an ugly, angry situation when that happens.
Do you think that there's any models from other countries, post-communist countries, for instance, for how the Iraqi economy might get back on its feet and for how, like, you know, a kind of business model or economic model might be established for the future?
I don't have a good answer to this question. Nothing really matches. But let me just lay out for you, I guess, what I think are the building blocks here. Iraq, of course, has oil. It has a lot of oil, and that can provide a lot of money for, you know, building of basic infrastructure, becoming a modern country from the standpoint of bridges and phone networks and things like that. What Iraq also has, and it's interesting to me, it's a complicated country with a business class that goes back far before the Ba'ath regime, far before Saddam Hussein. These are some of them big merchant families, and then you have a very large population of just sort of street merchants and traders. So there is an entrepreneurial history in the country that's very encouraging. The one question that I keep asking myself is, what is the danger of a kleptocracy evolving, where a small group of people in power essentially manages to gain control of the most important assets in the country? And in Iraq's case, that would be oil. It's hard to know. The government is clearly going to stay in control of the oil for a while, and the question then becomes, who is truly controlling the government and who's going to be benefiting? We just don't know if there's some powerful elite that will seize command there.
Before you went to Iraq, you were in Washington, which is where you are again now, covering economic issues for the New York Times. And you'd been writing a lot about the Bush administration tax cut plan. You were writing a lot about, problems with the economy in general. Then you go to Iraq and you see Americans basically handing out money to Iraqis. And you also see the Americans having to assume responsibility for a country and for its infrastructure and its people. And I'm just wondering some of the things that got you to think about watching the tax cuts here and the new responsibilities there.
Well, it's clear that the basic American formulas were not going to work in the short term. They had all these terrific crises to deal with. So notions of deregulation and low taxes were nice, but beside the point. You were dealing suddenly with a country that had no taxes in the first place, really, that had no law, no regulations. So suddenly the prescriptions that sound very good in the United States, let's stimulate the economy with lower taxes, let's give free enterprise a broader rein by reducing burdensome regulation, none of those things were relevant in Iraq. They didn't have regulations. They had no taxes at that point. Their problems were much more basic: electricity, security, order. And that's where the Americans found themselves suddenly gasping for breath and falling short.
And having to come up with different solutions.
Yes.
Any
embarrassing ones.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, the two embarrassing ones were to essentially condone a fairly large make-work economy, paying people for not going to work. And the second, of course, was being forced to print Saddam dinars because they hadn't figured out the currency problems over the long haul.
Edmund Andrews is an economic correspondent for the New York Times. He's just spent 2 months in Iraq. We'll talk more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, witnessing the looting of an archaeological site in Iraq, we continue our conversation with Edmund Andrews, economic correspondent for the New York Times. Also, the pop rock and alternative country music of the Jayhawks, we meet the group's lead singer and songwriter, Gary Louris. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Edmund Andrews, an economic correspondent for the New York Times. He just spent 2 months in Iraq and returned home late last week. His ambition was to report on the state of the economy in the new Iraq, but he ended up covering other stories as well. While you were in Iraq, I'm sure that, like everyone else who was there, you saw looting and crime. What is the worst looting that you witnessed?
The worst looting that I saw personally, by far the most shocking thing I think I encountered the entire time I was there, was the looting at archaeological sites. Iraq has about 10,000 registered archaeological sites. This really is the cradle of civilization. And what was happening was that people who had worked these archaeological sites for many years under the guidance of foreign archaeologists or under Iraqi teams had suddenly realized it was open season, and they were excavating tons and tons and tons of dirt at some of these sites and pulling out just extraordinary treasures, 3,000, 4,000 years old, entire urns, parts of statues, many, many, many cuneiform tablets. It was shocking. It was horrifying. And it was something that the Americans were totally unaware of at first and felt unable to do much about because these were often remote sites. But it was terrible. Imagine, if you will, 150 or 200 people crawling all over an archaeological site with dozens of holes, almost reminiscent of the movie holes, really, in the desert, and people pulling things out of the ground almost by the minute. It was extraordinary and shocking, and that damage, we won't even know how much was lost. These are things that were, of course, never categorized, but it was obvious from the range of things that I saw that the loss is huge. And of course, the archaeological sites have been destroyed. You can't make sense out of what was there anymore because everything has been turned upside down. So that was far and away the worst thing I saw.
So it must have been kind of bizarre to watch this going on in the open and no authorities are there to pay attention and stop it.
I have never been so scared in my entire life. I was absolutely terrified to go through there. The only reason I did was I was escorted by a woman, a German archaeologist who knew many of the people on all sides and felt that she had their trust. But even so, I was just absolutely terrified. There were huge numbers of guns out there. This was a long way from any town, and there was a lot of money at stake. It was a frightening thing to be at. And once I got there, I even forgot the safety aspects. I just found myself mesmerized by this extraordinary activity. I've just never seen anything like it. I'd never imagined anything like it.
Were you victimized at all while you were in Iraq?
Amazingly, no. I came out of Iraq without a scratch. I began to feel by the end of my stay that I had been so lucky I was surely going to get robbed or worse on the way out. There's a road that goes from Baghdad to Jordan, and Jordan was one of the places you would fly out of. And there's a notorious section of that road outside of a town called Ramadi in Iraq, where many, many people had their cars hijacked and robbed, and some people had even been kidnapped to be returned later. It was a dreadful place, and I was just sure that I was going to get nailed there on my way out, but I avoided it. I had a number of colleagues who did get robbed on that road and on the road from Kuwait. It happened. It happened, and it increased in frequency.
Were there things that you did to protect yourself?
Well, I thought about taking an armored car, at least past Ramadi, but what I did was what most people do in that case. I contracted with one of these services that drives the route regularly. They all drive GMC trucks, and it worked out very well. I was really kind of amazed. I was very impressed. When we got to Ramadi, I was driving with in one car, and there was another GMC truck behind. But once we got into the clear danger area, the area I knew was bad, suddenly it was 9 of these GMC trucks that converged out of nowhere and formed sort of a convoy, 3 abreast, 3 abreast, 3 abreast. And there was no way, and driving at 100 miles an hour, there was no way that that convoy was going to get stopped. So that's one of the things that you do, and it worked very well.
100 miles an hour, you'd better hope that they're well-coordinated, all these trucks.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It was my pleasure.
Edmund Andrews is an economic correspondent for the New York Times. He just spent 2 months in Iraq. Coming up, the pop rock and alternative country music of the Jayhawks. We meet the band's lead singer and songwriter, Gary Louris. This is Fresh Air. The pop rock and alternative country band, the Jayhawks, may not have the biggest following, but they have a devoted one. Their latest CD, Rainy Day Music, has gotten many rave reviews. A review in Rolling Stone says, "Alt country music is a seductive and unapologetic embrace of stuff that modern pop culture has left in the dust. Heartland melodies, steel guitars, heroines named Sarah Jane. And few groups are more seductive or unapologetic than the Jayhawks. Rainy Day Music is all lilting vocals and gentle acoustic fireworks." My guest Gary Louris is the Jayhawks' lead singer and songwriter. The band was formed in Minneapolis in 1985. Co-founder Mark Olson, who had shared the lead singing and songwriting with Louris, left the band in 1995. The new CD features guest appearances by Jacob Dylan, Matthew Sweet, and Chris Stills. Let's start with a song co-written by Gary Louris and Matthew Sweet. This is Stumbling Through the Dark.
You're so in love, little girl, so much in love, little girl, running around in circles, why, you know it's a crime, no less, no more than a rose, no less, no more than a rose, try to attach a meaning.
Stumbling Through the Dark from the Jayhawks' new CD, Rainy Day Music. My guest is Gary Louris, the lead singer and guitarist from the band, co-founder of the band. Welcome to Fresh Air. How would you describe the sound of your new CD compared to earlier one?
I think it's more acoustic guitar-based than our other records. It's a very live record, which is not something we've always done. This is, I think,
live, you mean not like overdubbed a lot?
Not overdubbed. I really like playing. I played the acoustic guitar and sang at the same time, and Mark played the bass and Tim played the drums, and sometimes we had a couple other people, but basically all at the same time together in the same room, as opposed to many people who we've done it in the past. You do the drums in April, and you find yourself singing the song in July, you know, and piece it all together to make it sound like it was all done at the same time.
One of the things I really like about the Jayhawks is the harmonies. And I think that harmony sometimes, like, disappears from pop music. Or I don't know. It's great to hear good harmonies. Are they important to you?
Yes. I think songs are kind of... The importance of the song is kind of disappearing too, and not to be somebody like, oh, the good old days. But songs and harmonies, there seems to be no room for harmonies because there's too many drum machines or whatever on there. In a certain way, I feel like out of time and doing something that seems less and less of today.
What was the good stuff on the radio when you were growing up and first starting to play and write songs? And what was the stuff that you like really hated?
What I really hated? I hated country music probably growing up. It took me a long time to appreciate it. You know, I listened to a lot of British rock, the Kinks and things like that, and Motown, I think. And then I definitely went through a punk rock period and my art rock period and listened to all kinds of different things. But music I hate, I probably country music was something I hated at the time, ironically.
Yeah, very ironically, since a lot of people, you know, can mm-hmm. consider your band part alternative country. What did you hate about it, and what changed your mind?
Oh, it sounded very square to me, and but it can be really heavy, you know, and the stories they tell, and it's quite powerful stuff. I'm talking about the 60s and 50s, 60s, 70s country, really.
And what was in your parents' collection, their record collection?
My parents were... My mother loved Andy Williams. She just loves Andy Baby, as she'd call him, and Ella Fitzgerald. My dad really was easy listening. I just remember sitting in the old, you know, Bonneville, driving somewhere, and he'd always have easy listening on. So to this day, I'll turn on an easy listening channel to take me back to the 60s. Otherwise, you know, Mantovani, I mean, like, really, our record collection was this little thing of, like, 20 records in the living room in the corner. And it wasn't really a big deal at our house.
Does it scare you to think that maybe like your musical genetics is like Andy Williams and Mantovani? That's what you were exposed to first.
That would not be good. No, I hope not. I hope I wasn't absorbing that.
Now, I want to quote something about the Jayhawks that was written in the New York Times a couple of years ago. This is when your previous CD, Smile, mm-hmm. came out. It was written by Karen Schomer. The article, this was in the Sunday New York Times. The article was headlined, "What If You Made a Classic and No One Cared?" And here's an excerpt. Smile, the name of the CD, Smile aspires to be nothing less than a classic, the kind of album teenagers stumble upon and hold dear for the rest of their lives. It wants to join a club with Van Morrison's Astral Weeks, the Beach Boys' Pet Sounds, Big Star's Sister Lovers, and other rock and roll benchmarks of loneliness and disillusion from the 60s and early 70s. There's just one problem. In this day and age, who's going to care? What was your reaction to that article? And did you share her sentiments that you know, this album's really good, and it's just like, no one's going to notice, no one's going to care?
What I remember about that article is, I remember picking it up and, you know, feeling pretty good about the nice things she was saying, but remembering that everybody else wasn't so happy. The record company, our producer, everybody, you know, they just didn't want to hear that people were not going to care, that people weren't going to listen, that people weren't going to buy it, because I think they were still hoping they would. I think I'm just resigned to the fact that we're never going to achieve a level of stardom, you know, and maybe it will take a while for people to come back to this music and appreciate it more. But we it's not like a sob story. We have really loyal fans, and but yes, we'd certainly love to appeal to more people.
No, I ironically, here's this record that, you know, we're talking about how Karen Schomer wrote in the New York Times that, you know, great record, but who's gonna hear it? Mm-hmm. You know, who's gonna care? One of the tracks from this record ended up on a Ralph Lauren commercial, and everybody heard it. They didn't necessarily know what they were hearing. They didn't necessarily know it was the Jayhawks, but a lot of people heard it. And the song is "I'm Gonna Make You Love Me." Let me play it. Let me play the record. A lot of people will recognize it, and then we'll talk about it.
Okay.
This is the Jayhawks from Smile.
Our world never ends. It's only the beginning, and we can't pretend to discover its meaning. We talk for hours at a time, and I came to my senses. You're more than a friend, you're my perfect lover. I'll never be
was the Jayhawks from their previous CD, Smile. My guest is Gary Louris, one of the co-founders of the band. He's the lead singer and guitarist. Gary, what's the story behind the song, and then how did it end up getting used on a commercial?
I guess it was written originally about an old girlfriend, and which is probably why my wife doesn't like the song at this point. And it was a song that, from the beginning, when we first started playing the demos to the radios or the record company Columbia, they initially said that's the song. That's the single, and they proceeded to say push me to rewrite the chorus and turn it into a bigger song. And that's something I haven't done very much of. And I don't know if I'd do it again, but I ended up going to people I respected, like Paul Westerberg and Jacob Dylan and Dave Perner and a bunch of my friends, people I knew, and writing the song, trying to come up with a bigger chorus, and ended up doing it over the phone with some guy from Nashville who came up with a good idea, and we ran with it. So it basically was the single that almost kind of happened, didn't. And then one day I was out actually in Cape Cod with my family, just kind of having a little vacation, and I got the call saying Ralph Lauren wants to use your song. And you know, I think in a dream world, I wouldn't have to use my songs for commercials. I don't like seeing my favorite songs used for a product. You know, it's I like to think that they're more sacred. But considering that Ralph Lauren's I think it's a pretty cool company. We went for it. Now, we didn't have to go through the actual viewing, because it was never really shown in the Midwest. I think it was more of an East-West Coast kind of thing, from what I understand. So I've actually never seen the commercial.
You've never seen it?
No.
The funny thing is, I have seen it, and I can't remember the commercial. What I remember is the song.
I think I was disappointed when I saw the commercial. I thought it was, I'd heard all these cool things, and basically it was just two models hanging out on a yacht and thinking, you know, what does this have to do with the Jayhawks? But you know, it's you do what you have to do nowadays, I guess, to make a living, and that was one of a concession kind of.
So did you think twice before saying yes, or?
No, I actually didn't. I remember thinking twice back in the early 90s and almost regretting that I did. I think Levi's asked us to write a song in the 90s, and back then we were a little more idealistic, less jaded, and you know, we said no, but they basically said, can you do a write Waiting for the Sun, but use 501 jeans in the lyrics somehow? And it was a little uncomfortable.
So you said that the bridge for
Waiting for the Jeans, I guess it could have been called. Excuse me.
You said the bridge for I'm Gonna Make You Love Me was rewritten to make
the chorus.
The chorus, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So what was it originally?
It was called Someone Will, and you know, it was a special little song. It had a very small little chorus that was subtle but kind of cool. But you know, it's a tough call when you go out and play that song every night, try to figure out whether you made the right decision in rewriting it. But
does the other song have a life, the original version?
It's on a little CD that we sell at shows only that we made ourselves. It's called Live from the Woman's Club. And it's us playing acoustically. And then we've added a couple of the demos that we've made in the past as a little bonus. And people can be the judge if they listen to it. It's called Someone Will, and that's what it used to be. And
well, you brought one with you, so why don't we hear it?
All right.
All the world never ends. It's only the beginning. Oh, tell me your mind. Please pinch me, I'm dreaming. We talk rounds at a time, just to tell me your stories. You're more than a friend, you're my perfect lover. I'll never be all you want to, but that's alright.
that was the original version of what is now I'm Gonna Make You Love Me. Any other thoughts on that?
I think for a while I thought, well, why did I get talked into changing the song and turning it into a, what we consider more of a commercial song? And I always held it very dear, and many times felt like I don't even know if I want to play it anymore, because it felt a bit like a sellout. And now I've gone back and we've tried playing it the old way to see, and I think it probably is better the way it ended up. You know, so sometimes you're not always the best judge of your own song.
Because it's so hard to get indie rock played on music stations, and because so many people who make commercials seem to want to have like hip indie rock music on their commercial, do you think that some people are finding out about bands now through commercials? You know, whereas in the past it was like, oh my God, you sold out, your music's on a commercial. Do you think that people hear music on commercials in a different way now and actually find out about good bands from commercials?
I think so. Actually, some of the more interesting music I've heard is usually on a commercial. Well, mainly because the radio stuff is usually so incredibly boring. But I think Moby had a lot to do with that. I think his manager realized that he was probably not going to get radio play at the time. So somehow he got some incredible amount, like 800 licenses on that record. So they used his music, the music off that record, like 800 times on different commercials. And I think that's what made him a star.
My guest is Gary Louris, lead singer and songwriter of the band The Jayhawks. Their latest CD is called Rainy Day Music. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Gary Louris, lead singer and songwriter of the band The Jayhawks. Their latest CD is called Rainy Day Music. Mark Olson, who was in the band till, what, 95? He was your songwriting partner for the first 10 years of the band. Did you have to learn how to write songs without him after he left and the collaboration ended?
No, I didn't. That doesn't mean that I don't miss him as a writer or that... he wasn't important to me, because he was, or is, as time may play out. We may write some songs. We have written some songs together over the last couple of years, and we may write some more at some point.
It's hard to keep the band together when one of the founders leaves.
Well, it was pretty devastating. I mean, it was because I thought we were kind of on to something. And to this day, I'm a little bit bitter, but, you know, I don't know why.
Yeah.
Well, you know, at the time, I totally understood it. But now looking back, you think of what could have been, and you think, I understand totally why he did. It made sense that, you know, he wanted to be with his wife and to make music with her and be with her. And, but, you know, you can't help but wonder what we would have done. But you know what? Once he left... we kind of said, well, I think that's probably going to be it. I remember it was very emotional. It was like a Halloween, around Halloween. And we were sitting at my house, and we were working on some new songs. And I could tell something was weird. And he left, and he called me about 5 minutes later. This is in St. Paul. And he said, I got to come back over. And I kind of knew it. And he came back, and he just said, I can't do it anymore. I can't start this all up again. And we kind of both cried and hugged each other and said, oh, that's it, man, that's it. A couple weeks later, I started realizing that the rest of the band really wanted to stick together. Everybody's like, we got to keep going. And we were a band. I mean, yes, it was Mark, kind of the Mark and Gary show, but Mark Perlman and Karen Grotberg and Tim are all really talented, we're really talented people. And they wanted to keep going. And we worked so hard to get where we were. It took, you know, it wasn't easy for us to get where we were. And if anything, we had too many songs, so we decided to continue.
And are you comfortable performing the songs that he wrote before he left?
Well, I don't. I never. I write songs only that I wrote or mm-hmm. I co-wrote.
Mm-hmm.
But I will not write a song. I will not perform.
Perform a song, yeah.
I will not perform some of my favorite Jayhawk songs, actually. Two Angels is one of my favorite Jayhawk songs of all time, Nevada, California. Could never play those, which is too bad, but... I can't go there, as they say.
Gary, a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks so much for coming to talk with us.
It's a pleasure.
Gary Louris is the lead singer and songwriter for the band The Jayhawks. Their new CD is called Rainy Day Music. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with another track from The Jayhawks' new CD. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of The Elegant Gathering of White Snows, a novel about eight women whose impromptu walking quest touches a nation, by Chris Radish. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Now, when I was a young boy, at the age of five,
the next Fresh Air, the life and music of Muddy Waters. We hear from Robert Gordon. His biography of the blues singer and guitarist Can't Be Satisfied has just been published in paperback. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air. 21. I want you to believe me, baby.